As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of The Forum Club. I'm Bill Oram, joined by Anthony Slater and Jovan Buha. Guys, we have an injury, the first real injury of the season. Anthony Davis going down with what is currently being termed a calf strain. Obviously has been some soreness around that Achilles area. Anthony Slater, I'll start with you. You covered Kevin Durant when he had actually kind of a similar evolution of his injury in the finals. How worried are you when you hear the words Achilles tendon and Anthony Davis in the same sentence?
The Lakers better not hope it follows a similar timeline. It's funny. If you go back to last week's podcast, me and Jovan had a conversation about the rising concern level of this injury, which I now think is the most relevant storyline in the NBA, because you're talking about the prohibitive favorites now are wobbling a little bit because we don't know where their second most important player's season is heading. But as far as the Durant situation, I don't know how well you guys remember it, but it was second round Rockets game 5. He pulled up lame on like a jumper and like reached at the lower calf Achilles. Night of, people were like, he might have just tore his Achilles. Then I remember going into the locker room, he's still in there, he's walking around fine. And it was like, I even asked him at the time, I was like, you're good? Like, it's not an Achilles, right? Because that really was the online concern. He's like, no, it's like calf, lower calf. And that was confirmed, and they really tried to rehab him back. And I'm trying to think of the math here, but it was probably a month later he tried to muscle his way back into the finals game 5. He was not ready, clearly. Apparently, all the doctors, you know, in retrospect, all the doctors on Durant's side, on the team side, said it wasn't putting his Achilles at risk. It was lower calf, even though, you know, you'd go and see him when he was trying to get his way back into the finals and he was icing very, you know, lower calf Achilles. Like, it looked like he was icing his Achilles, basically. And then disaster strikes. He tears his Achilles early in the second quarter, misses the entire year of his prime. Again, this, like, Davis's prognosis sounds different than Durant's. Durant's was a calf strain that was more serious. It forced him to miss over a month before he then tore the Achilles. But yeah, anytime I hear these terms and who we're talking about, it's a scary thing for the Lakers, as you guys know.
So we're going to dive into all of this, all the sort of ramifications of the injury, the opportunities it creates for some other guys, what we saw from those other players in these, I guess, three halves of basketball we've seen so far, and then the matchup the Lakers have, the matchups they have coming this week with Brooklyn and Miami. A whole lot to get to, but also we're going to do something a little different this week, where at the end of this podcast, we're going to have a special guest. I have a conversation with one Dan Wojcicki of the Los Angeles Times for a little trip down memory lane to a funny moment in our basketball writing history that I shared on Twitter this week, and there's more to the story. So Dan and I are going to be talking about that at the end. But I want to bring Jovan in here. Jovan, you have really broken down some of the ramifications of AD's injury on this particular Lakers team. Now, it's right now, we're expecting him to be out for 2 to 3 weeks before he's reevaluated. Who knows what that reevaluation says or how long he ultimately ends up being sidelined. But obviously the timing here is probably as good as you could hope for, with the playoffs still several months away. How do the Lakers get through this stretch?
It's going to be difficult. You look at that 5-1 record without AD, and that's encouraging. But when you look at the six teams they've played, it's the Timberwolves twice, the Thunder twice, the Pistons, and the Bulls. And five of those six games actually went into crunch time. You know, the only convincing win the Lakers have had during that stretch was that blowout of the Timberwolves, you know, the third game of the season right after Christmas. But aside from that, they've really struggled in the five games without AD, and they have a brutal stretch coming up. They got the Nets, they got the Jazz, the Trailblazers, the Warriors already went into Staples and beat the Lakers. So like, it would not surprise me if they end up around 500 over the next eight games. And I know that's kind of blasphemous for Laker fans. You know, I saw some people thinking they're going to go like 7-2 or 8-1 in the stretch, and I just don't see it. You know, I think even last night, you know, while there were some encouraging things, I was still a little discouraged by just sort of the overall flow of the game, and that it took the Lakers really until midway through the fourth to turn it on, have a 15-4 run to put away the game. So I think offensively, this team has enough guys to kind of stop the bleeding offensively, where Dennis can step up, Trez can step up, even Mark and Markieff were more involved and were hitting threes. Like, I'm not as concerned with the offensive end. It's the defensive end, where there were some brutal stretches where the Timberwolves were just living at the rim, going downhill at will. And the Lakers just don't have another guy to kind of step into that role. And, you know, it's going to have to be by committee. But I just think the drop off from AD to the next best front court defender is pretty steep. And I guess LeBron, when he turns it on, can do some of those things. But we've seen, a little bit of a more conservative approach from LeBron defensively recently. So if there's any concern for me, it's the defensive end. And I don't really know how they solve that.
That is a very diplomatic way of calling LeBron, saying LeBron's been coasting on defense, that he's been, what did you say? Sure. He's been a little more conservative on defense or something like that. I mean, this is a team that already has had a shortage of rim protection. And that is something that Jovan has kind of highlighted and circled over the last few weeks as a growing concern as the numbers have come back to reality a little bit. And you take Anthony Davis, who's really their only one, you know, high-flying rim protector out of the equation, who does block shots for them? Do they need to hasten that emphasis on the buyout market or in a potential trade? Or do you just look at this as AD is going to be back before the playoffs? That's when they're going to need it anyway. So just get through it.
Yeah, I think that's the way you do look at it. My thing is, like, this is Montrezl Harrell's time, right? Not to suddenly start blocking shots. Nobody thinks he's going to do that. But you don't have to play championship defense for a 14-game stretch. You could just, like, this was the discussion we had preseason when they signed Montrezl Harrell, right? It was, he might get played off the floor in the playoffs in certain matchups. He might be a playoff downgrade, but because we expect some type of rest patterns for LeBron and Davis, we didn't know the details of it. We didn't know it was going to be this Achilles scare, but we figured these two were going to coast at times or sit at times. Montrezl Harrell and Dennis Schroeder, but really right now I'm talking Harrell because more it positionally fits. He was going to have to carry the load, and he is a good regular season player, particularly feasting against average to below average teams. And I would love to hear your guys' opinion on what you've thought of Harrell's season to this point. But to me, you can win games. You can win enough games in this stretch without great defense if Harrell is just being like, you know, prime Clippers Harrell. He's getting you 20 and 10s on the regular. He's super high energy. And yeah, he's giving up some stuff defensively. But most of the teams you're playing in this league are getting killed defensively right now. So
it's interesting. Like, I don't know if I feel like much is going to change for Montrezl Harrell in this stretch. You know, I don't think that, you know, the lineups he's on the floor with are going to be that different from what we've seen. You know, it's like, Jovan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, we don't see a ton of Montrez on the floor with AD. And so when we think about people I expect to really have an opportunity to step up in his absence, I'm looking at Kyle Kuzma, Markieff Morris, who has been in and out of the rotation, Mark Gasol, who's going to have more offensive touches now, and then Dennis Schroeder, who, again, somebody has to make up that scoring. And I think, you know, with the exception of Kuzma, Montrezl Harrell last night in the game against Minnesota did exactly what he's been doing all year. You know, bringing the energy, putbacks, you know, almost had a double-double or did have a double-double. I can't remember.
He only played like 18 minutes though, right?
But he was really effective in those 18 minutes, yeah. And then, but then Schroeder played super well. You know, got hot early, really kind of set the pace offensively. And then Markieff Morris and Marc Gasol both hit their shots. And I don't think you can necessarily count on that night in and night out, but it did feel like kind of like the thesis statement for how they need to, where that production is going to come from in these games without AD.
Jovan, let me ask you, what have you thought of Montrezl Harrell's season to this point?
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
To me, he looks pretty similar to last season. I've said this before in this podcast. Like, there was an overcorrection on Montrezl Harrell's perception after the 2020 postseason. And you know, it was a disaster, right? Like he was not himself, and he was targeted defensively and picked apart, and then in the offensive end, just, you know, wasn't finishing through contact and all that stuff. But to me, if you look at the numbers, like, really the only difference between Trez this season and last season is his shot attempts. You know, like, kind of looking at per 36 or per 100, everything else is in line. You know, the rebounds, shot blocking. He's actually finishing, you know, better around the rim and is, you know, more efficient with the Lakers. And I think a lot of that is just the way they're using him as more of a finisher than he actually did a bit of posting up and ISO stuff with the Clippers last year on that second unit. This year, he's been more of a dump off guy. You know, they're starting to use him as a roller a little bit more recently. But I think he looks like Trez to me. Like there's a lot of pros to that, right? Like you've seen, he's won the Lakers, I think, a few games this season just with his energy and effort in those second unit stints of, you know, he just pulverizes second unit bigs for the most part. But you've also seen his defense been an issue. I look back at that Portland game. I look at the Golden State game. You know, like these teams with guys that can shoot off the dribble really can target Trez in the pick and roll. So I think that, you know, Trez is who he is at this point. I haven't really been surprised by anything this season, other than maybe the way the Lakers have used him is slightly different. But I think he's a guy who helps you in the regular season. But I do think come conference finals, I do have some questions defensively of how he can hold up against the very best offenses.
Is this potentially his most important month of the season, though? Because, you know, maybe Frank Vogel's of the mindset of, look, I'm going to, it seems to be, if we're basing off last night, he's still going to play his 18 minutes. He's going to give us what he did. We'll fill in elsewhere. I know Kuzma gets the start. You know, and maybe that's just because Davis is coming back, you kind of want to keep that same formula. But it does seem like a chance to just say, hey, Montrezl Harrell, you're going to get, you know, they're going to give a bunch of extra minutes to him. You're going to play worse defense. You're going to kind of try to beat teams offensively, which you can do in the regular season. You've seen it for years, Jovan. Montrezl Harrell beat a bunch of teams in the regular season. They could switch styles like that, but I guess if you're trying to keep that championship defensive DNA, maybe that's just not the strategy.
Well, and you guys just kind of touched on it a couple of minutes ago, but I thought it was really interesting that Frank went with Mark for 30 minutes and Trez for only 18. And I do think after hearing Frank's post-game comments that part of that might have just been trying to get Mark in a rhythm. You know, if you look at Mark has really struggled this year, and his two best games have just happened to come against the Timberwolves. So I think once Frank sensed that Mark was feeling it offensively and having a good game, he probably just wanted to ride that and view that as more important than another good Trez game, because Trez has had several of those, you know, 18, 20 point games this year. So I thought that was interesting. But overall, I do think that shift will probably be a little bit more even where it's 24-24 or something like that. But I actually dug into this in my piece on how I thought the offense would change with AD out and the defense. And it was really interesting to see that, you know, there wasn't one guy in particular who really benefited. I guess the guy you would say would be Kuzma, you know, averaging almost four more points a game. But if you look at the minutes, the shot distribution, the points, it really is a trickle-down effect of everybody in the rotation is more involved. It's not just Kuzma. It's Trez. It's Dennis. It's Wes Matthews. It's THT. It's you know, Alex Caruso, like everybody gets more minutes, gets more shots, gets more points. So I do think there really is, you know, Frank's been talking about this by committee approach. And I know that's kind of coach speak and a little cheesy, but I think there is something to that where it's not just Trez is going to step up, average 25, you know, Kuz is going to average 18. I think it really is everybody's just getting a couple more shots. And because of that, they're all a little bit more productive.
Jovan, you said something that I thought was really interesting, and I agree with. The Lakers could go 500 over this stretch, right? And that may not be, you know, we might be talking about fewer than 10 games if it ends up being just until the All-Star break. That's 9 games. But if they drop 4 or 5 games here before the All-Star break, do they just need to write off the one seed in the West? And if so, how do we feel about this team being seeded 3rd, 4th? Going into the playoffs, because coming into the year, I was very vocally making the point that seeding did not matter this year in arenas without fans, although more and more arenas are adding living, breathing souls back into seats. How do we feel about seeding and how important is it this year?
So this kind of reminds me a little bit of the second Durant season with the Warriors. There was literally a moment in March where all 4 of their All-Stars were hurt at the same time. Curry had an MCL sprain that actually kept him out for a while. Klay Thompson broke his thumb and Kevin Durant broke his rib on the same night in Minnesota. And then Draymond had a knee issue. And they literally went, I'm looking at the stretch now. They were 3-7 over a 10-game stretch in March, which is very rare for them. They actually went over 2 seasons without losing 2 games in a row. It was an NBA record. But it was like, you know, they went 3-10, and that led to Houston getting the 1 seed. And that was the story at the time. You know, we talked about, like, you know, these guys are going to be back healthy for the playoffs, but is losing the 1 seed, you know, a big thing? And I remember talking to them at the time, and Draymond, you know, particularly behind the scenes, like, look, we're just going to win in Houston Game 1. And then they did. They just went and won in Houston in Game 1, and like this, like months of conversation and lead up and everything about it led to that moment. And then they went out and just won by 12 in Houston in Game 1. I was like, oh, okay, well, we took home court back. So personally, no, I don't. The only thing that is the advantage right now when you look at the West and how it's stratified would be whoever is the 1 seed only has to play the Clippers or the Jazz, or, you know, if you're Utah, to me, it's most important for Utah. If Utah gets the 1, they only have to play the Clippers or the Lakers, because those two right. will have to play each other. So that's the difference. You're just going to have to go through both instead of 1.
That's right. And honestly, like, there's just not a matchup where I'm like, oh man, you're the Lakers. Now you're going to have Portland in the first round again. The path is maybe a little bit tougher from the 3 seed or the 4 seed, but I still don't see anybody outside of, you know, kind of the usual suspects that I'm afraid of on behalf of the Lakers once they get to the postseason. To me, it's still the Clippers. Utah has certainly made its case. I'm excited to see that first matchup next week when those two teams finally play. But like, I still am not convinced that is not a, you know, Lakers in 5 win. I think really it's just a matter of getting there healthy and then take each of those series as they come. I mean, I go back to LeBron in his last year in Cleveland when they were, what, the 4 seed, I think, and they nearly lost in the first round to Indiana. And then, of course, they made it back to the finals for a 4th straight year. So, I think you put LeBron with this team healthy in the playoffs, and I think they're going to be there in the end either way.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano, and we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called 6 Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture themed trophies for 6 basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make 6 Trophies your go to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow 6 Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I think to your guys' points, like, there's a chance that the path is, and the West standings right now are so weird that, like, I guess if you're the 3 seed, there's a chance you're playing Denver in the first round or maybe like a Phoenix, and you know, that's probably tougher than the average first round opponent. But I do think there's such a gap between the Lakers and everybody else that it doesn't really matter. And I think the other thing is that I think to Anthony's point, like they're in the second year of this. So if this were the first year, I think it would matter more. But you know, the fact that they've already done this, like you can be the 3 seed or the 4 seed. And yes, you know, maybe you end up with a Denver, Utah, Clippers path, and that's probably the hardest possible path in the West. But I think there is enough of a gap between them and everybody else that it just doesn't really matter.
I would like to see them have a tough path because last year was kind of, you know, it was dull a little bit by the end, right? Because we thought we were going to see the Clippers in the West Finals and suddenly it was Denver. You know, Houston kind of petered out a little bit. Portland felt like petered out in that first round. So that would be fun.
Once the Clippers lost last year, I mean, it was just, at that point, it was just a matter of playing the games. Like, I mean, with all respect to Denver and Miami, and there were moments that were compelling, but it's like, it just like took all of the air and tension out of like, even can the Lakers win a championship? I mean, again, like all respect to those teams, but they were never beating that Lakers team. It wasn't going to happen. And it just, it you know, I wouldn't mind some intrigue this year, frankly.
Oh yeah. And then my second point would be, what will home court matter this year? I don't know. We don't know at all because we don't know what type of fans are going to be allowed in arenas. Utah actually does allow, I think, something like 1,500 fans right
now. Yeah,
that's
a lot.
That's still not like, you know, a packed Salt Lake with people courtside yelling in your face and it's going crazy. And so I'm not sure. You know, it was the Lakers dealt with it last playoffs. There wasn't a home court. They literally, that was like the ultimate just sterile environment in Orlando. So it'll be a, you know, you don't necessarily want to play 4 out of the 7 games in Utah, but it doesn't feel like it's going to be like past seasons.
I've got a question for you guys. I get this question literally every game when I do the post game pod of, you know, who should the Lakers add as a third center and do they need another big? And you know, my stance has been that I think a third center would be nice only as insurance for Mark or Trez, right? Like if one of those guys, let's say AD was healthy and it was one of those guys who went down for a month or so, you know, now you'd be in a position where AD has to play the five. And we know that he doesn't really want to do that in the regular season. So, you know, in that case, maybe you do go out and add a Dwayne Dedman or try to find somebody in the G League, or maybe it's Devontae Kaycock. You bring him up. But now with AD out, you know, it does to me kind of, it's somewhere in the middle of that where I'm like, on paper, they still have those two centers. So I don't really think they need another center, but you know, do they need another power forward? Do they need another wing? Like,
well, my opinion, I'm covering a team right now that literally does not have a healthy center. Like they're just completely injured and they're playing pretty well because it's the 2021 NBA, right? Like you can, particularly in the regular season, you could play a stretch of 10 games and just go completely small. The Houston Rockets purposely did it last year. Remember that Rockets team they played that just was like, we don't want centers anymore. I think they're important. I think that the Lakers have a good group of bigs, but I definitely think they could survive this, you know, chunk of games. And people think about, a lot of times too, think about these alternatives like they're going to come in and be super impactful. Like Dwayne Dedman's not stepping into this Lakers team and like winning them games early on. I don't believe. You know, maybe if we talked, like I do think that's maybe who you target on the buyout market, and the Lakers clearly are going to be like a premium buyout market, you know, buyout market team because they always are. But I don't know. I mean, you guys are following the team on a day-to-day basis. I just mean in the 2021 NBA, I don't necessarily think that they're in a concerning spot with the big men. I mean, Gasol's playing solid enough. I think Harrell should probably be getting more of a chance in the regular season, more minutes maybe. And then Markieff Morris is doing his thing on the minimum off the bench. So I think they're fine, personally.
I agree. And I also just wonder, you know, if you logically think through who they might face in the playoffs, what matchup is just screaming at you that they need an additional rim protector, or that they need a 7-footer back there, you know, wiping the board clean? I don't know. I feel like that they have shown that defensively with the guys they have and the way they defend, that they are able to compensate for whatever, you know, deficiencies they have. They built this team very specifically to the teams that they're going to encounter in the Western Conference. You know, the center matchup that you would worry about is Nikola Jokic. And I don't know that Marc Gasol is the Nikola Jokic stopper, but that is a matchup where I feel like the Lakers have sort of made their chess move. I don't know that I see a matchup where it's like the chess move needs to be having Hassan Whiteside, you know, be your 13th man.
You do not want Hassan Whiteside playing for you in the playoffs. Let me tell you that.
You know what? All I'm going to say about Hassan Whiteside, and this is
he blocks a lot of shots. Yes, go ahead.
This is the point I will make about Hassan Whiteside relative to this Lakers team, because like he is kind of the name I always throw out when it's like, who could the Lakers add potentially on the buyout market? The reason I am, for whatever reason, not scared of Hassan Whiteside, and I know you're talking very specifically X's and O's, but like there's a lot of baggage that comes with Hassan Whiteside, and a lot of reasons teams do not want Hassan Whiteside. I didn't think the Lakers should sign J.R. Smith. I didn't think the Lakers should sign Deion Waiters. I didn't think the Lakers should sign Dwight Howard. I was not sold on the Lakers signing DeMarcus Cousins. I did not think the Lakers should sign JaVale McGee or Rajon Rondo the summer before. I was right about Michael Beasley and Lance Stephenson, but the Lakers have been really phenomenal at bringing aboard guys with baggage and bad reputations around the league who were viewed as potentially causing problems and not being a problem. So if, let's say, Hassan Whiteside was available and the Lakers were interested, I would be fine with him being your 13th, 14th guy that you might throw out there to erase a few shots, because I wouldn't worry about the other stuff.
The Hassan Whiteside experience would go like the J.R. Smith or Deion Waiters experience. They'd sign him. Sure, he would probably not derail their title hopes, but he would be sitting his ass on the bench when it mattered. He was
on backside.
He's just not really a winning
right
center component for a team, particularly with a Frank Vogel and a LeBron James who are like, need this certain type of playoff discipline basketball. You know who would help them in a series against Denver and Nikola Jokic? Dwight Howard. But you're not getting him. You're not getting anyone that would do anything, I don't think, on the market right now for Jokic. The one interesting name that could potentially be out in the buyout market if Cleveland doesn't find a trade partner is Drummond. But to me, he's the only needle mover big man that might come free.
Yeah, I said it, I think, last night that if Andre Drummond or Blake Griffin is available, I think they're probably worth, I mean, like, but Blake would be a tricky fit.
Ooh, I've seen some Blake this year. It is not what it used to be. He has zero dunks.
His best game of the year against the Lakers. So, I mean, if Magic Johnson was still running the team, I mean, he'd be trading four future picks for him.
This is how beat writing works, where Blake had his best game against the Lakers, so you guys are like, I could see it. And Blake maybe had his worst game of the year against the Warriors, and I'm like, do not enter. But
I'm not kidding. That is how Mike Muscala became a Laker, was Mike Muscala had his best game, like the game of his life, against the Lakers in 2018, and that inspired Magic Johnson to trade Ivica Zubac for him. The Clippers were going to waive Mike Muscala, and instead they got Ivica Zubac because Mike Muscala had his best game against the Lakers.
It was also a horrendous trade of Zubac, but
one of the worst.
I think if you put like Blake in the Markieff role, you know, I feel like he could do that. It's you just don't want him as like the centerpiece of your offense. But I think, you know, aside from those two, which I think they'd probably end up in different situations than signing with the Lakers. Like, I just look at it, I'm like, okay, Dwayne Dedmon, he's been out there. They haven't signed him. So I think, you know, that there's probably a reason that they've passed on it, or maybe they're just waiting on it. But like, looking at, like, I think they're fine, right? Like you said, between Mark and Trez, you can get 48 minutes. And if you really need to downsize, we've seen them even go with Keefe at the five. It's really, I think we've talked about it in previous weeks, like they could probably use another 3-and-D wing, like, you know, Trevor Ariza, if he becomes available, or someone of that, you know, kind of skill set. I think, sure, like you can probably use another rangy wing defender who can hit some threes if you're not super confident in KCP or Wes Matthews doing that. But aside from that, I don't really see another clear fit or rather need for this team.
They have one issue right now. It's Anthony Davis' Achilles. If he is healthy and playing in the playoffs, they are the favorite. I would pick them in any series. My question I want to ask both of you, and I know Jovan, you talked to a doctor, is where is your concern level with Anthony Davis' long-term health? Because if he's not playing, there's not an Anthony Davis answer out there, right? I mean, if he's not healthy for the playoffs, I wouldn't pick them. So that is just like problem one, and it's a steep drop off before we get to any other issue. So where is the alert level for you guys on that?
I'm not that concerned, because we were talking about a player who has, you know, dealt with a lot of things throughout the course of his career. I am fully in the camp of letting him rest as long as he needs. You know, if this drags into April, I think that is totally fine. Get him so he comes back at full strength, 100%. And, you know, you have time. You have time on your side. You have really kind of everything you would want in this scenario. You have time. You have another superstar who can carry the load. You have the confidence that comes with winning a championship. There's really no reason to start panicking about this unless it drags into the postseason or, I mean, heaven forbid, you know, he comes back and somehow re-aggravates it. That is the only issue. And I don't know, you know, when you're dealing with tendinosis, you know, that is something that just doesn't really go away. And in one sense, you know, we were listening to AD the other night, Jovan, talk about how the only thing for it would be rest and that he wasn't going to rest. And by aggravating it and getting this additional swelling, having the strain, he's being forced to rest. And I don't think it's a good thing or a silver lining that he got hurt, but I think maybe having his hand forced to sit and rest and get this thing fully resolved and maybe take care of some other nagging things along the way could ultimately end up benefiting him.
I agree. I'd put my concern level at like a 5.5, a little bit above average, just because with the tendinosis, and I feel like I'm in med school right now with all the Achilles research I've done over the past few days, like it is a chronic condition that just doesn't really go away. And you know, I witnessed it covering the Clippers with Kawhi and you know, his tendinosis in his quad, and that ultimately became something where he had to load manage and start sitting out back to back. So I think like the sore or the right calf strain or the right Achilles strain or whatever, like those injuries alone, you just need to rest. You know, that's fine. Give him a few weeks off. But the fact that the Lakers listed him as out with tendinosis, it was reported that he has tendinosis post MRI. That's where the concern starts to kick in, because this isn't something that is just going to go away with a few weeks of rest. Like the sore right calf or your right calf strain, that can be solved in a few weeks and he can be back post All-Star break and look like AD again. But you know, he's one move away from re-aggravating that and potentially, you know, inflaming his, you know, the tendon sheath and all that stuff. So I guess there is a little bit concern on my end of this could be something where he returns, looks fine, and then re-aggravates it deeper in the season. So I don't know if, you know, like, I don't know when this is going to fully go away, if it ever is. And, you know, this could just be something that he has to deal with for the foreseeable future. So I guess I'm not too concerned because we don't know the severity of it yet. But I think tendinosis is something that, you know, obviously is a lingering issue. And that's my only kind of, you know, pause with this situation.
The body part is just, it's a scary one to throw on the injury report when you hear it. And to be honest, I feel a lot worse about the Lakers' title chances just because of this than I did 3 weeks ago. And it's just been thrown into the mix. Maybe it's because what Bill opened the entire podcast talking about, the situation I covered with Kevin Durant. But you just don't like hearing this type of stuff. And, you know, you mentioned Kawhi and you covered that Clipper situation where it was load managed. I mean, that derailed an entire season for him in San Antonio. That's probably why that relationship at its core broke up. So not saying anything like that's happening with Davis and the Lakers, but I just
it didn't help last season either.
yeah, exactly. So it's just thrown something into the mix that just wasn't in the mix a few weeks ago. It just doesn't seem like it's going away. You know, it's not like he twisted a right ankle kind of bad and he's going to be out 3 weeks while his ankle, you know, rehabs. It's something with more of a long, wider scope story to it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, I think that probably it concludes our
story time.
Discussion. Is it the story time?
I think it's Dan Wojcicki story time.
I've got Dan Wojcicki on hold, just chomping at the bit. No, guys, so let me set this up for you real quick, and then I'll get Dan here. But 2014, the Lakers had the number 7 pick in the draft. They didn't have a pick in the second round, and they came out of that draft with Julius Randle and Jordan Clarkson. And if you've been paying attention to the league this week, those are two guys who've been in the headlines. They both had career highs on the same night. Julius Randle might be an all-star in the East leading the Knicks, and Jordan Clarkson is in the conversation for sixth man of the year, if not the favorite. And Dan and I had a funny experience that night of the draft that those two guys became Lakers. We're going to tell you about it right now. Now, Dan, I normally wouldn't have a competitor from a rival outlet on the podcast like this, but this is an extreme circumstance, and it actually harkens back to a time when you and I were colleagues at the Orange County Register. You were covering the Clippers, and I just want to set it up. In 2014, you were covering the Clippers, I covered the Lakers, and the Lakers had the number 7 pick in the NBA draft. They drafted Julius Randle, and then later that night, they bought into the second round and drafted a guy named Jordan Clarkson, and those ended up being pretty good picks. And especially this week, they've both been in the news. Both of them had career highs. Julius Randle looking like an all-star in the East. Jordan Clarkson could be the sixth man of the year. But we have a story that we tell all the time at parties about that night in the draft. And it's a story that I shared just a small piece of on Twitter this week. And some people were interested and they wanted to hear the whole story. I would like you to take it away. Please tell us, start at the beginning of the night you and I ended up drinking with Jim Buss and Chaz after they drafted Julius Randle and Jordan Clarkson.
Yeah, I mean, I think, where do we start, right? I think that the best place to start, right, is first of all, that I never would have accepted this invitation had it not been to tell this single story, which is one of my favorites because of just its sheer absurdity, randomness, and I guess luck. But you and I met for drinks after the draft. It was a much more eventful draft for the Lakers and it was for the Clippers. The Clippers took CJ Wilcox, a shooting guard, a very nice guy, but who was, you know, I believe a Utahn. Is that how we say that, though?
Yeah, he's a Utahn. He played at Pleasant Grove down in Utah County and then went to the University of Washington.
Yeah, so great guy. Never really was able to figure it out in the NBA, though. Anyways, so we ended up deciding to meet in El Segundo, where I was in an apartment at the time, to just have some drinks after the draft. You know, the type of thing that we would do every so often. And I believe we started, if memory serves me correct, at Rockin' Brews and had a couple of beers outdoors. And it was just going to be like, let's just have a beer type of a situation, right? But there, because of it's so open air there, they had to close earlier than normal restaurant bars, I think at 11. So then we moved from there to the Tavern on Main in El Segundo, which, to kind of set it up, is just like sort of like, I don't know, it's like a very neighborhoody bar, right? You had on the right side there, it's like better lit and there's TVs and stuff like that. And then on the left side of the bar, it's just kind of more like restaurant seating and a little darker and a little, seemed a little scuzzier on that side, I guess would be the word I would use. And we're just kind of talking. And while we're talking, this was, I believe, your first year covering the team, Bill, is that right?
It was my first draft, so it was the end of my first year covering the team.
Okay. At some point, I mentioned a story about just an all-time great NBA figure named Chaz Osborne, who was a Lakers scout who I think was immortalized, memory serves me right, in a Ken Berger story.
Correct,
Bill?
Correct.
When like, I think, and the line, I believe, about sort of the Lakers overall levels of dysfunction, and the line was something like, bad scout, great bartender, or something in a way to describe it.
Nice guy, great bartender.
Nice guy, great bartender. Yeah, right? Which is like, ultimately, all that really matters. And like, so anyways, I'm telling you about this story, and we're talking about it. Minutes later, a group of men kind of saunter in and sit on the dark side of the bar in like the far corner away from everybody else. And you are like, oh my God, that's Jim Buss. And it was Jim. I think Jesse was there, right?
Jesse Buss was definitely there. Yeah.
And there may have been someone else. I don't really remember. And you were like, at first you weren't sure if you should go over.
I didn't have a relationship with these guys yet. I'd only covered the Lakers for a single year. You know, I didn't know, I'd met Jim Buss when I first joined the beat, but you know, it's not like, you know, I spent a lot of time hanging around the scouting department, you know. So Jim Buss at the time was the executive vice president of basketball operations. You know, he and Mitch Kupchak were in charge of building the Lakers rosters. And at this point, the Lakers didn't have a head coach. Mike D'Antoni had just resigned, you know, a few weeks earlier. Everybody thought they were going to hire Byron Scott, but they hadn't done anything yet. And I'm like, you know, I'm pretty green and new on the beat. And I'm like, am I supposed to go over and like start talking to these guys? Or is that like inappropriate? Should I let them just like have their night? But also it's like when opportunity walks through the door in the form of Jim Buss and an unidentified figure who might be Chaz, you probably should go say hello.
You went over and talked to him for a little while. And I think you left either your phone or your keys or something at the table we were sitting at. I kind of, you know, I was covering the Clippers. I didn't go. I kind of let you have your thing. And then finally, I'm like, I'm going to go over there. And, you know, I introduce myself to some people. I say, like, oh, I'm Dan. I cover the Clippers. And they're like, ooh, you know, kind of like a little playful razzing. And as I'm shaking hands, I shake hands with this guy who introduces himself as Chaz. And my head, like, almost just explodes, right? It's like, we're now in the world of nice guy, great bartender. And, like, from there, it's just, like, the governor has been taken off the go-kart engine. It is, like, full speed ahead for the next, like, two or three hours, right? Like, we just have, like, the greatest time talking about everything and just drinking. Like, a lot of drinking. We close Tavern on Main, and like it's you know, and I think that's like a 1:30 last call or something like that, 1 o'clock last call, and we kind of walk out on the streets of El Segundo, and which, for people who don't know, El Segundo is like very small towny, Mayberry, like literally like the busy street is Main Street, and there's a handful of bars in and around the area.
It's the Mayberry of Los Angeles.
Yeah, for sure. Like a moniker they've like kind of playfully enjoyed. And so we end up, we're like, let's keep it going. Let's keep rolling. Like I'm like very much in that space. And they're like, you know, there's like an element of like, nah. And then like, they're like, no, we're still going. Like, I think it was like Jim was like, we are still going. And we end up going to a much divier bar named The Office Downtown, which would best be this, it's like sort of like kind of like an armpit would be how I would describe it. It doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. Like tucked between like an old fish shack and the place where I used to do my laundry. And we go in there, there's like no one in there. And we just like, we just take over the bar, right? So this is where I, to me, like, I just got like all these just like super illuminating insights into who Jim Buss was from one night. Jim Buss reaches into his pocket and pulls out, I think like a $5 bill. And he's so excited that he has like cash, right? Like this is Jim Buss, the owner of the Los Angeles Lakers for all intents and purposes, like stumbling onto some money and being so happy, handing it to me and saying like, go do the jukebox. Right. And so I go to the jukebox. And I put it in. I think the first song I played was like Tom Petty's American Girl, song I love. And like Jim just starts like air guitaring like crazy, right? Like, and we're both like kind of like air guitaring and like just being like just total morons. And at some point I say to Jim, I'm like, Jim, like, oh my God, like Tom Petty's so great live. Like I saw him on the 4th of July once in Milwaukee and there's fireworks going on in Lake Michigan. He's amazing. Like, you know, you love music. Have you ever seen Tom Petty live? He's like, yeah, Dan, you know, like my dad, he used to own the Forum. So I've seen him before. And he did it so naturally, like in a way as to say, like, what building did your dad own growing up? Like, where did you get to go to free concerts at? And anyways, like the night kind of devolved. We talked about like horse racing a ton. He loves, you know, I think he's working with horses now, right, Bill?
Yeah, I believe so.
Is that, I think, what he's doing?
Yeah.
Because I grew up by a racetrack. So we talked a ton about horse racing. And it was like one of those nights where it was sort of like you got so drunk and had so much fun that you sort of vowed that moving forward, like you would be friends, right? Like that this was like we've established these relationships and we will move forward and be best friends forever. And I don't think I spoke to any of them ever since.
See, that may be true for you. I talked to Chaz like, I don't know, a month ago for a story I did on Marc Gasol, because Chaz was working for the Lakers at the time in a scouting role. And I was trying to, you know, piece together kind of a story about the Lakers drafting Marc Gasol with the 48th pick in 2007. And, you know, did they know what they were doing? Did they know that they, you know, who they were getting there? And I called up Chaz and he was great for the story. But it reminded me, because after that night, I think at the Tavern on Main, you know, I was like, so, you know, what do you think of your draft, Jim Buss? And Jim was like, oh, we really like Randall. We really like Randall. And I said, well, what about this other guy you got, Clarkson? And Jim Buss, like being very honest, like told me he didn't really know anything about him. And that, you know, that wasn't the guy that he was targeting at number 47. And listen, like that is not a huge shock. You know, when you're dealing with, you know, the scouting department, which is now run by Jesse Buss, you know, often, you know, has, they have a list, right? Like of guys that they target and guys that they think, you know, could be available in these ranges. And, you know, you can't, you don't necessarily expect, you know, the executive vice president of basketball operations to know every single name on that list, you know, by heart. And Jim made some comment about how, like, they had someone else that they were interested in there that came off the board. And fast forward into Jordan Clarkson's rookie year when he was, you know, playing pretty well and looking like maybe he was going to be an NBA player, you know, let alone the player he has become now. And I tweeted something along the lines of, you know, this is great for Jordan Clarkson, who actually wasn't even the guy the Lakers were targeting at number seven, like what, a, or number 47, what a great find. And the Lakers were so pissed. They were like, what are you saying? Like, what, like the basketball operations department says that this is not true. What are you basing this on? And like, you know, it's like I had to protect my sources at the time. So I couldn't be like, well, John Black, former vice president of comms for the Lakers, I know this because I got really drunk with Jim Buss at the tavern on Main the night of the draft.
So you remember the other thing that I remember being struck by that night was just sort of like, so this is, again, what year is this? I'm 2014. So like at this point, like craft beer is like kind of a thing, but more like imported. There's like more like kind of like a fancier imported type beer. It is sort of like, and I remember being struck by just like how like working man, like Jim Buss drank. Like if that stands true, like I believe, like I remember him buying Bud Lights for some reason, a lot of Bud Lights. And you tweeted about fireball shots. I don't recall.
Oh, I 100% remember fireball shots at the office. Yeah. At the end of the night.
Oh, that might've just triggered. It was at the end of the night, right?
Yeah.
Like at the very end of the night, there were some extra shots.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that now. It was, I mean, it was like one of those things, like it was a bar's bar, right? Like jukebox, pool table. And it had that game where there was like a washer on a string and like a hook on the wall. You know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea.
Like, you would have to try to like drop the washer and get it to like land on the hook. I remember playing that with Chaz a little bit. Chaz, by the way, was like such a fun guy.
I think in general, like the point of telling this story is
he's
like
on Twitter, by the way. I found him on Twitter.
Chaz was doing like some media stuff recently. He was like, you know, covering the Raiders a little bit. I think doing some podcasting about the Raiders. So I mean, Chaz is around if you're looking for him. But to me, it's a fun story and a funny memory, especially because of what dark times that was for the Lakers. You know, where they went through they had such a string of bad years, and that was kind of at the beginning of it. Jim Buss left the Lakers in shame, really, you know, after being fired by his sister, you know, obviously tried to seize control of the team from Jeannie. You know, there's a lot to unpack when you talk about the Buss family, but as a snapshot of like what Jim Buss was like or is like, you know, that stands as one of my favorite memories of, you know, being in, you know, being part of the Lakers media crew for years and years and years. And like, I remember Jim Buss telling me about like the relationships he had with the media. And he was like, yeah, you know, like I talked to Brez. We talked about like, you know, hanging out at the beach and going and playing beach volleyball. I talked to Dave McMenamin about his kids. And I'm like, yeah, Dave McMenamin doesn't have kids, Jim. So... but for years it existed.
I just imagine a very polite Dave McMenamin inventing children to like continue to have these conversations. Like, yeah, Chip is great.
All right, Dan, before we let you get out of here and return to your children, you actually do have a child, unlike Dave McMenamin. Any other lasting thoughts about this memory or anything you'd like to say about Julius Randle and Jordan Clarkson since their big weeks were ostensibly the justification for dusting this story off?
Yes, I think real quickly, and can I plug my stuff real quick? Like, so I actually wrote a little bit about this week in my Lakers newsletter. And it's a fun reminder, too, is like it sort of reminded me of like if you go down like through your Instagram and look at pictures of like exes, you know, and like occasionally like it'll look like really good, but you should remember that your situation probably right now is probably better. And I know that like I don't really buy any of this super hand-wringing about would the Lakers be better off if they had like kept all these guys and stuff like that. I mean, look, they reached the mountaintop, right? Like they won a title with Anthony Davis. It's super hard to do that. Like you are 1,000% in the right always to make that trade. But this, I think it was just kind of a fun week of like, just sort of like, you know, like hitting the old Facebook and like looking back at like what could have been.
Yeah.
With these guys. And that's sort of the vibes that I got. I got them. Not that I've ever done any of these things. So I've never done that. But I would assume that's what it would feel like.
Great analogy. Great way to end this podcast. Dan, can't thank you enough for for jumping on and sharing that story. Yesterday, you and I were texting about it, and you said we should tell that story on a podcast someday. And I was sitting down, and I was like, wait a minute, I have a podcast. We're going to do this. So thank you for indulging me. And like I said, Dan covers the Lakers for the LA Times, my bitter, bitter rival. But unfortunately for him, also one of my closest friends. And that's so right. These are stories we talk about all the time. And glad we could bring you one of them on the Forum Club. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with Anthony Slater and Jovan Buha. But in the meantime, enjoy the Lakers this week. Some big games on the horizon. And we'll talk to you soon.